You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, the show of all sorts that sorts all by serving up a slice of life. What is your order? Ah, I see. The special it is. We'll be there to deliver ASAP. Cosmic Pizza Podcast Special Delivery.
Hello and welcome to your special delivery of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. I am Dan, and with me today, as always, is
Paul from the UK
and Sean from Timmins, Ontario, Canada.
And we are here to serve you a slice of life in every show. And in today's delivery, we are going to be delivering a single pizza, but it goes in three different directions, three portions, because we are going to be talking to the ever talented Mark Boucher. Mark Boucher is not only an author, he is a director and a podcaster. So it's a trifecta. We've got lots of content to talk about on today's show. We're going to talk about the book in a moment with Paul. And we're going to talk about podcasting in general with Sean, and then going on to Poking Books, which is your podcast short, Mark. But before we get started, how do we know you? How have I managed to wrangle you into this show?
Can I start by saying that cutting a pizza into three slices is the most deranged way to... It's mathematically weird. I think you either go for six or you just like do two if you're that. Yeah. Hello. So Dan and I went to school together. I think we actually met through a school production of Animal Farm when Dan was Napoleon and I was Squealer, the propagandist. So that's probably, I think that sort of foreshadows where our lives ended up. Dan is a cruel Stalinist dictator, and I'm just spewing propaganda to the world. So,
It worked out perfectly. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely great. Yeah, I have a short complex, and I don't like to talk about it. Anyway, and... Yes, Mark Boucher is a dear, dear friend of mine because he was actually there when I started podcasting 7 years ago. And he was my first guest on the now defunct Riding Coattails podcast. And he was very gracious with his time and gave me a lot of content. And it was a challenge to edit. Was it 4 hours we were sat there talking?
Were we?
Trying to get it. Yeah, oh. I think it was about 4 hours. And it was the first time I'd ever edited. And I was like, why am I doing this? What on earth is going on? But you showed me all the little tricks, how to get rid of the noise and all that kind of stuff. So I am forever grateful because you got me into all of this and got me started. So thank you very much. But yes, we've met at school. Then we moved on to our university lives. Yeah. We were in two different universities, but in the same city. In the city of Canterbury, they have got Canterbury Kent, and then they've got Canterbury Christchurch. They've also got CIAD, which is a sort of arts university as well, but we don't talk about them. They're the third raters.
I couldn't mention, so Dan, I started hosting a radio show at my university, and I didn't really want to do it on my own. I wanted to do it with Dan, and I don't think we ever mentioned that you were not from the university. It did Dan and Mark's Happy Crappy Hour. And we got kicked off air. They had an FM license for 2 weeks, and I think we'd heard that after a certain time of night you could basically do what you wanted, so we were swearing, we were playing a certain song by Blink-182 about a dog, and they actually came at about midnight and dragged us out of the studio. And Dan went on to win Best Male Voice shortly after that one. And he was so nice about it because he'd won and I had walked out of the awards thing because I was like, I can't bother, we're not going to win, we got kicked off. And Dan came and said, like, oh yeah, we won. I was like, what did we win? He said, best male voice. And I was like, we both won it. And he's like, yeah, it was kind of a thing, you know, it was a sort of compromise sort of thing. I was like, oh, that's nice. So I went and told people, knowing it was nuts, and they were like, no, Mark, Dan won it. He was just being too nice.
So where are we going with this podcast then? So are we going to get kicked off the ESO network, and then the Cosmic Pizza will go defunct after a few weeks after having Mark Bowsher on? So I think, is that a precedent, is it?
It's a challenge, it's a bar. And
a very low bar.
Well, then we can definitely hit it.
Exactly. Set the expectations low. That's the thing you're going to learn from this episode of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. Always set the bar nice and low.
Cosmic Pizza Podcast, set your expectations low.
That's how Dad did it. That's how America does it. And it's worked out pretty well so far.
Yeah, America's going pretty well at the moment.
That's very true.
Actually, no, it is. I got so stuck in the Trump thing, I keep forgetting that it's over. And that there's hope and peace in the world.
It's only just begun, as somebody once famous said.
But moving on from our tumultuous past in the university, we also did a little creative work on your sketch show, which is called Caflet.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about Caflet to us for a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where it started. I think I was on about 14, 15, went out. My grandpa had a camcorder and he lent it to me, and I started going out with my friends and filming sketches. And that's where I first learned. I'm like, I don't know how much later, like 20 odd years later, I'm making, you know, a lot of my living out of editing. And I started off with two VHS recorders and a SCART lead, because someone told me you could edit videos like that. And that's kind of how everything started. And I think at one point my CV started with saying that I started with my grandpa's video camera, until somebody I knew on Facebook who runs a film festival said, like, oh, I'm so sick of reading filmmakers who say their career started when they used their father's, grandfather's, dead aunt's video camera to start their careers. Okay, I'm taking that off. But clearly, what everybody does. So, yeah, I carried on for a long time. I miss sometimes doing very serious documentaries at the moment. I miss doing comedy.
Speaking of, you've moved into documentary filmmaking. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
So, I basically have been a filmmaker freelance now for the last 7 years, which, you know, has it a lot of ups and downs. And it started with me making a few films that won awards. And Dan was actually did a voiceover role in one of the films, The Watchers, which is probably my favorite of the three films I made that won awards. And then I ended up sort of being made redundant from a job, and then decided, like, I'm not doing office jobs anymore. I really want to do this. This was my dream to do it. So I got a rubbish job in a supermarket, starting at 4 a.m. in a bakery. And then just so I could set up, right, that's a job I don't care about. I'll do that to make some money while I try my hand at filmmaking. And I've slowly sort of worked my way up. And I'm lucky that some of the favorite clients I've had is I approach people all the time to say, I really like your company, your business, or whatever. I'd like to make films for you. And that's how I got to making films for a company called Unbound, where I made a lot of films for authors for their crowdfunding projects. And like, sometimes I do some of these 2-minute videos. I do about 8 of those a month because, you know, you're doing crowdfunding books, you've got a very tight budget. But they were such good things to do, because you just chat to somebody and you're basically trying to work out what it is about not just their book, but them, that will make people want to try and crowdfund their book. And that's crossed over what I do now, because I now make history documentaries. And this, I've sort of used the same system of, instead of going in there with too much of an agenda, I go into each history documentary to learn and to try and, you know, do a condensed version of the nuanced story that historians I speak to do. And this But it came about because my brother Jack just subscribed to History Hit, which is Dan Snow had the biggest listenership for a podcast, history podcast in the UK. So he turned it into this History Hit, a live version. And then this turned into a whole streaming service, which is basically History Hit is Netflix for history buffs. And he saw this newsletter saying they were looking for, my brother Jack saw this newsletter saying they were looking for filmmakers. And I applied and I pitched a few things. I was like, I suppose this is what you do. And I was like, I think I can make a full documentary. And then they came back and they said, yeah, sure, your work looks good. Here's some money. Do you want to go away and make something? And I was like, God, I've got no idea. Like, I'd pitched 10 things, and the one I'd done on statues, it was basically in reaction to the statue debate. I wanted to do something quite nuanced based on how after the Second World War in Germany, they had stopped. I went in with the idea of they've stopped celebrating heroes and are trying to remember victims. And the story is much more complicated than that. And I, went in saying, I'm not just going to speak to British historians. I want to speak to German historians, their history. And had some amazing responses, and people, they're the best at being critical as well of their own country and sort of the good and the bad. And it's that same approach as Unbound, that you just talk to people and then you want to represent that. It's a lot of work to edit that down into something usable, but they really responded well to it, and they've kept commissioning stuff. And now it's, that's the main thing I'm doing at the moment. I really enjoy it. I mean, I can talk more about sort of how lockdown has kind of changed it in a weird way for the better, but I don't know if you want to move on to something else or...
Please do. Yeah, no, I'd love to see, because presumably it would have been a pitch meeting. You would have then been given the subject matter, and then the script, as it were, with sort of the talking heads and presumably an unlimited supply of resources of, where you're going to get all this information from, and then go out on location. But now that's changed.
Well, also that whole system you've just described is not really what happened. It's kind of also that they had, I went to them and pitched some ideas because I heard they were looking for people and didn't think I'd get a response. But they said, yeah, sure. And they asked me about budgets, and we sort of went back and forth. And then, they said, oh, yeah, no, that amount's about sort of what we would commission. And then they just basically left me at it. They didn't give me any resources or anything because I said, I want to be a production company. I don't just want to be me. I run Rabbit Island. Rabbit Island Productions is, I've always been working with other people. I work with a filmmaker, Iris Gibson. It's a British Austrian filmmaker, and Jake Martin, who did some work with, he went and filmed with Michael Palin in North Korea a few years ago. Those are people I've worked with for years, and we wanted to do something as a team. So we had the resources to do it, but it was also a bit of a problem because the guy said, but are you going to film in Germany for this? And I was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. But one of the first people I worked with, Mike Kleinsmith, did most of the Unbound videos I did, moved back to Germany. So I spoke to him and I said, well, maybe since it's lockdown and I can't go there and we wouldn't have budget to anyway, I'll give you a brief and you can go out and film things. So I sort of virtually scouted it, had a chat with him, and he came back with suggestions. And so he had a day of going and filming without me there. And he said, I had a great time. No director breathing down his throat. And I was like, this is nice to have somebody you trust, and that you spend time picking the right person and working with them beforehand and then leave them to do it. And then, but we then said, but there is someone we want to interview. And I was like, but I really want to, interviewing and chatting to people and getting a good response out of them is the thing that I do. And I really, really enjoy about the job. So we arranged to speak to a lady called Susan Nyman. And we recorded her in, a place called Treptow Park, in Berlin, which I would absolutely suggest going to. It's spectacular. It is the Soviets built a park as a memorial to themselves just after the Second World War, and it is this incredible place. And she tells a very good nuanced story, saying like, we need to remember the Soviet contribution, and she's critical of it at the same time, because money was spent on this in the early, you know, just after the Second World War, when they should have been spending money on infrastructure of people and still housing for people to have there. But she tells a really good balanced, very passionate story about it. But I interviewed her basically by Skype with the phone attached to the side of the camera, and then Mike uploaded the footage for me later. And we've carried on doing this. So I really like now hiring local filmmakers and working with them, and then I could speak to people all over the world. So it's filmed properly. And we have done a few interviews by Skype, but I've actually said I want to move away from that, because the quality is better, obviously, if you film it. And then so we've worked with several interviewees in America, one in Haiti for the Haitian Revolution documentary, and Italy as well. Yeah, we still get to have some in the UK and travel about a bit, but it's really changed things. And it's good, because I've always been worried about this kind of carbon footprint of stuff, and there's stuff I'd like to make that was traveling, but maybe that would be more stuff in Europe if we had the money to, you know, to travel over ground. And I would love to do projects, because to work, you know, you spend that time finding the right people. I used to work with an Australian filmmaker, Sarah Steele, who actually does a really good podcast called Let's Talk About Sects. I remember her saying, we used to work in a job together. So like, the important thing is like not criticizing things that go wrong. When you're working in a place, you should pick the right people in the first place and trust them. And that's something I like to do. You know, you spend a lot of time picking the right camera operator, the right DOP, the right interviewees, and you trust them and you work with them. You know when to step in and do something, but also you know when to just trust people to do stuff. But I'm just working on my sixth for History Hit. I've done one on the German one I mentioned, one on Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh, and one on the Haitian Revolution, which is an absolutely incredible story. Everybody should read up about the Haitian Revolution. And also on Mansa Musa, the West African king, who we definitely need to know a lot more about, and the First Britons is the latest one, which really, you'd be surprised how few people know our own history. It's incredible.
Speaking of which, have you heard of the Battle of Brunanburh?
I haven't, no.
Okay, so it's probably the biggest battle that ever took place on the British Isles. And basically, at the aftermath, it formed what is now known as the UK, as the shires and all of the basically where we live now, and they reckon there's two places this big battle could have taken place. It is starting to lean more towards where I live, which is on the Wirral, just south of Liverpool, on the little peninsula stuck out there in between here and Wales. They've been digging around trying to find where the battle site was, and they've come up with, it could be in Bebbington, where I live now. It could be in Bromborough, which is a few miles down the road. It could be in Morton, which is up at the top end of the Wirral. It could be over in Barnston, which is a few miles the other way. And it could even be in the golf course, which is not far from where I live. It could be in Easton. It could have been anywhere on the Wirral. They are now reckon that it is none of those. It is, in fact, all of those, and the battlefield is the entire Wirral. So, if they can, they've got enough evidence to really sort of think that this was the place. They reckon they can see where the people have come in from the sea, with descriptions that have been in the books of the time. It sort of describes coming across the sea and then onto land in a certain place. They did think it was over up in the northeast, but it's more likely now that it's over in where we are now. So if you wanted to do a historical piece about, you know, the something like that, it would be some people down here that you can get in touch with and talk to them about it, because it's a fascinating thing. If it is as good as it sounds, and we do have the whole area that is this big battle, I'm hoping they will put a some sort of like a mock village
enormous
up.
Plaque.
Yeah, huge. Yeah, blue, yeah. Like, knowing us, we get a blue plaque. Yeah, that's about as good as we get up here. But I'd like to see them build like a little small village of the time and have actors come in and play the parts and things. That would be so cool if they could do that.
If the battle is the whole Wirral, I mean, that's going to be a massive blue plaque. I mean, you've got to blot out the sun. Yeah. You've got a dome.
That's right.
It's a dome. You can see that it's a plaque from space, but it's actually a dome.
Yeah, Google will have it as a big, it'd just be a dome on the top of the a big plaque on it.
It's learning history, and it's reducing the carbon footprint. You know, it gets rid of the global warming, just reflects all the sunlight.
Just depends on the carbon footprint of building the dome in the first place and who you outsource it to, really. But
there's always a catch. There's always a catch.
Yeah, no, but that's an incredible story, and not one I know. And that's the kind of thing that is always interesting. And although I've tried to move away from just sort of traditional sort of things of battles and things that, you know, I think that's, but it's also the kind of thing that, having a relationship with someone like History Hit could even be something for Dan Snow if he hasn't.
He's had a sniff around, I believe, but I don't know how, what was filmed and what wasn't. He filmed it a few years ago, and they didn't really know where it was. So I think it was just a quick sort of, it could have been here, and then moved off. But now since then they've sort of said, in fact, I'm looking at Wikipedia and it's out of date. But we went to a presentation of, I think it was last year sometime, and they were about to announce it, and they couldn't say anything at that point. And somebody said, where do you think the actual battle took place? And he said, you're stood
everywhere.
On it. Yeah, you're stood on it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. If it turns out to be true, or if they can prove it, to a point, I don't think they'll ever really sort of be able to say for definite, unless they dig up a huge hole. But there's loads and loads of bits and pieces around the area which they've done all the radar or whatever they use to find things, and they've been looking for battle sites and looking for places where people would be buried. But it's just so big, they reckon there probably wasn't any.
It's I mean, from speaking to historians, I quite like that. Every time you do a documentary, that gets to a certain point where a historian says, "Oh, I don't know." We just don't know yet. Actually, Mansa Musa, actually, the documentary is full of that, and it's incredible. What's incredible about the story of Mansa Musa is that so much should be known about it, and it was so well known at the time, like all over the world, his story was known, and now. People either like they vaguely know the name, they don't know the name, or like, oh, isn't he the richest guy in the world who ever lived? And like, well, there is that story, but it's actually massively complex to know if that's true. And the point is, if we knew more, we'd know. But he could have been. it also reminded me that this sort of multiple scenarios thing is something I want to play around with a bit. In the next film I'm doing, which is about the assassination of Julius Caesar, which is the first time they've asked me to do something without me pitching it. But it also reminds me of, and I think this is mainly because a historian I was speaking to was saying there were three different scenarios of how he might have died and the actual sort of details of who stabbed him and what he said, if he said anything. He said there were three different scenarios, and I just finished watching I May Destroy You, which in the final episodes has this sort of three different scenarios thing, which then also made me think of a DVD Dan once bought me, which was the film Clue, that has like these three multiple endings. So I think, I might be slightly influenced by that in making a Julius Caesar documentary.
So do you hear that, History Hit? That's my inspiring gift that I gave to your director, just to let you know. Can I just get a producer credit or something like that, just in the credits on one of the episodes? That'd be fine.
You need to ask for an executive producer credit. That's the sort of biggest you can get doing the least effort is the sort of thing.
Perfect.
I mean, they're usually the one who gives money, but I think you can just be nice and get it.
All right, I'll write that one down. Executive producer. Excellent. Fine.
Don't give him ideas. He'll be trying to take over the Cosmic Pizza podcast. He's only here as an ideas man.
Told you that it was prophetic, him being Napoleon.
Exactly. Yeah. That was exactly what I was going to say.
Did you say,
I'm ready to take
over.
Did
you say prophetic? and not pathetic.
I did say prophetic. Yeah.
Well, on that note, as I'm about to take over, History Hit is an example of a network of television shows. So I think it's probably a good time to pause here and put in an advert for one of the wonderful shows on the ESO network.
Great things are coming on the Nerd Bliss podcast. We're changing up our presentation while keeping the candidness that you enjoy. We'll cover all your favorite shows and movies with maybe a few surprises along the way. And you, yes, you, will have opportunities to be on our show on a regular basis. That's right. You've got the Zoom Pro account and we're going to use it. So be ready. Find us at nerdblisspodcast.com and esonetwork.com and on all the socials at nerdblisspod. Nerd Bliss. Listen up.
That was a great promo. Thanks for putting that in
there. I'm only learning from you, Sean, and how you managed to get him in every single time.
Yeah, it's all about the segue right into the promo.
Exactly. And sometimes it just comes to you. There you go. That's what an executive producer might say. So there we go. Right. Thank you very much, Mark, for covering all of that. That is fantastic. And hopefully, you know, some of our listeners will go and explore History Hit and watch some of your wonderful documentaries. But we are going to move on to another part of your creative portfolio. He is sickeningly talented, Mark Banshaw. I have said that about him before. He is just so creative. So we are going to move on to another string in his bow, and that is being an author. And I'm going to hand over to Paul.
Thank you very much, Tom. Yes, this is hearing that we were having Mark on the show. Dan said, "Oh yes, and he's written a book. It's a children's book is how he first said it." And then he said, "Well, young adults is basically where it's aimed at." I said, "Oh, good. Yeah, I'm into books. I can read a book." And I was looking for something to read in between this mammoth 20 book read of Asimov stories that I'm doing. So this was a nice distraction, really. So it's called The Boy Who Stole Time, which is a book like I've never read before. And I mean that in a good way. It's just remarkable. I was thinking, oh, it's going to be Enid Blyton or Roald Dahl or some, David Walliams or something along those lines. It's going to be aimed at young kids, and you know, I'll read it and I'll probably enjoy it, but it'll just be aimed a bit lower. Oh, was I wrong? This is not only aimed at slightly older kids, it's sort of mid-teens, I would assume, mid to late teens even, but it's good enough for adults and is written in a style that it doesn't talk down to anybody. I was expecting a more sort of light-hearted, sort of a really sort of fluffy pillow type of book. Oh no. This is Harry Potter gone rogue. This is an amazing book and has had me thinking about it for the last couple of weeks while we've been sort of waiting to record this. It's been going over and over in my mind, and I've just absolutely fallen in love with it. I've fallen in love with the settings, the characters. It's just an amazing piece of work.
Sure, and thank you very much. That's really nice. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. It's good. I like the sort of not talking down as well. I learn from people like Philip Pullman, who just speaks and is very simply like, "I'm not going to talk down. I'll just write this thing." The story. Do you want the potted history first?
Yes. Yeah.
So the story is about a 12-year-old boy called Krish, and Krish finds out that his mum is dying, and I think, like a lot of people, he thinks for the first time about, you know, I just want to give her more time. I becomes quite sort of frustrated at this idea of not having more time, and this is when he is visited by this creature, this strange creature that he calls a devil because it's so strange and cruel. And she tells him that time is a real substance. And she tells this story of time, of clocks and sundials and things being crushed up to make this stuff that the essence of time itself, Mithali, and that it was stolen and has spread out into these different worlds. And he is sent out on this quest to try and find it to a very small world. And there's a portal. I hate books where you kind of have just, it's too easy to get into the portal. Like with each story, there's going to be a different sort of convoluted way of getting into that world. And that the only way to get back is to touch a single grain of the Mithali, but that may just be more difficult than you think. And he goes to this world, this small desert world called Alea, where days and nights are so short, and there are these moons called Mother and Sons, which is it's like one moon with these four small moons going around this. I really love this idea of seeing this moon, Mother and Sons, going round and round and round. And that he, when he's there, he sort of goes and he meets King Absendi, who has the Mithali, and he sort of doesn't know what he's doing, so he blunders into the palace. And this palace is made out of, I love this idea, and I saw it from watching a documentary about ants, a palace that is made out of living people, that the king has made up laws, just ridiculous punishments, like I think pig poking's ones that's mentioned in it, and that whatever excuse that he can come up with to imprison people to keep his palace in check. And this horrible sort of he calls it the breathing palace. And he goes there and he just tries to beg the king, just not knowing what he's doing. I wanted him to be really super naive in the first book. And the king just mocks him and says to him, if you can fetch me a still flaming feather of a fire hawk, a pearl from the night ocean, and tie a pretty bow around the world, you can have it. And this sets him off on the quest. There's this whole sort of system where he finds a way to try and screw over the king by going on this quest. And he meets up with this sort of razor-tongued girl wizard called Balthrea. And Balthrea, for reasons that are sort of not quite clear at first about why she hasn't got much going on in her life and why she is motivated to try and help him and their friendship. And a lot of the book becomes about that. I didn't mention this at all in it, and so many people latched onto the character of Balthrea. She's such fun to write, and I think I did write her in a Gravesend accent as well. And yeah, so the book is about this quest, and will he get there? Will he be able to screw over the king? And while he is going, the king clearly sees this as a threat because he sends the Volrain, and the Volrain are these beasts of shadow. They are these dogs that will only ever appear when Krish closes his eyes, and they only catch his scent when he closes his eyes, so he has to keep his eyes open for as long as he can. He's really haunted by these terrible beasts, and yeah, it's just wonderful writing dark stuff. And when you're talking about the age range, I always think it's younger than you think, because, you know, I've known 7-year-old kids who've got into this. It's Kids love darkness, and the existential stuff doesn't seep in quite as much as it does for us. So, yeah, that's what it's about.
That's the beauty about this. Yeah, that's the beauty about this book, though, is age 7 can read it and get one thing out of it. The mid-teens will get another thing out of it, and the adults will see a different thing. It's amazing how it will span that age gap. It's amazing, because I know for a fact, if I'd read this when I was 7, the adventure would have been everything. If I'd read this when I was, you know, 15, 16, then the characters, forming together, and the, their interactions between each other, and how, whether they like each other as a, younger brother, younger brother, older sister type sort of thing. As you get into the older bit, you start focusing more on the parents and more on the, how is he going to help? What's he going to do to help his mother? And will he lose his mother at the end of the book? Or will it be more that he's got his experiences will ready him for the inevitable passing of his mother? And it's just so many layers that you can read this, and so many directions you can come at this from. It's absolutely amazing. And that's why I say it's not like a book I've read before, because adult books will deal with one thing, and kids' books will deal with the kids' stuff. But this has gone for the whole range. It's one of those things. If I see a TV program and you're still thinking about it in a month's time, then that has had such an effect on you and you want to go and watch it again. This book has done the same thing. I want to read it again. And you know, I put it down about a week ago and I'm still thinking about it now. It's wow. It's crazy. And I just love the images in my head that your writing produces, because I had this, you're going to tell me I'm wrong, but I had this in my mind, because I haven't been to as many places, of being sort of set in a sort of Northern Africa, Morocco sort of setting, more probably towards the Arab regions I would have thought it comes from, but also it could even be as sort of like a bit of a Turkish feel to it as well, with the bazaars and the and I just love the trap market, the idea of that. I think I've been in one of them. I swear to God, I've been in a trap market. That is, we were in Turkey and we walked in there and we were in there for days. I mean, it just seemed to go on forever. And it was the same people coming up to you saying, hey, buy this, sir, buy this. I couldn't get out. And then, you know, and this, the idea of the trap market is it's only about 100 feet long, but they're disassembling it at the back and building it at the front so you can never get out. That's just hilarious.
That was a really last minute addition as well. I'd come back from Egypt. And it was actually, the big influence was Morocco, actually. I spent 10 days there and that really stayed with me. And I loved it. And I kind of didn't want to just base it on Morocco. I kind of wanted the idea that the land could, you know, that you could go into greener pastures and things, and there was a bit more variety in the landscape. So I was trying to find somewhere. I started, when I've sort of dreamed about sort of doing trips in Africa, I was doing research and trying to work out where between Sudan and Ethiopia you sort of start going from desert to green. And that sort of in my head is where I'd imagined it, but I've just done a film with I've been working actually with another filmmaker called Boubacar in Mali for the Manza Musa documentary. And then I was thinking, like, it could even be around here. There's so many great stories about Manza Musa, and it's so magical, some of those stories, that I was kind of like, I wish I'd known more about Manza Musa, because it might have come into it more. Yeah, Morocco is definitely an influence.
Yes, yeah, good. I'm glad I got that. Because I was thinking, it's probably not going to be here at all. It'll be somewhere else. And I've never been to Morocco, but it's just from seeing things on TV. That's the impression that I got. You know, I've been watching a lot of Hercule Poirot recently, and a lot of that is set in sort of North Africa and is filmed in that sort of area.
A lot is filmed in Morocco as well. There's a big there's a place called Ouzazet, and there's a big film studio there. They film loads. They must have done some of Game of Thrones there. They definitely did Spectre there, and there's a place called Ait Ben Haddo, which is a mud city. Which is an incredible place. And this whole place made of mud, and I think that might come into it somewhere. But Ait Ben Haddo is where Maximus gets sold as a slave in Gladiator. Khaleesi goes there in Game of Thrones at one point. It's one of the cities she takes over. You will have seen Ait Ben Haddo on loads of things. It's in The Living Daylights. I think it might even be in some. No, it's not in Lawrence of Arabia. I'm thinking of another classic film of that era. But it's been used in so many things. I've probably seen it and don't even realise it's Morocco.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. A while back we were talking about one of our previous podcasts. We were talking about immortality and living forever, and what you would do if you lived forever. The idea of some of the characters in this book is basically too much time corrupts, and it having, you know, the extra time that the Mithrali gives you, that you get bored and you have to invent new games and new things to keep yourself amused, and this is where the viciousness of the king comes in. It's you know, he's just sat there with so much time in his hands. Oh, kill some more people, you know, for my enjoyment. It's just, he's becoming so vicious. And it reminded me of a quote of from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that Douglas Adams puts in. It says, life is wasted on the living. And I think it's pretty much what is happening to these people. They've got too much time on their hands.
Yeah. No, I do like that idea of sort of... I do like the idea that when you get these characters who have the Mithrali, that they will use it in different ways. There's another character later in the book, and it's hinted that they might, you know, what would they do if they had it? And yeah, in different books, I'll look at different characters and how the person in the possession of the Mithrali, or whether it's an untapped thing, you know, how they might use it differently.
So you've hinted there at more books. Are you working on one at the moment, or is it something to, you've yet to come back to? Or
I wrote the first chapter of the second book the same night that I finished the first one. And that was in 2015. So I've been working on it for longer than the first one, but that's because I went back and rewrote the first one and spent more time on that in between, where in years I've just dropped it. And I think I came up with the idea of the second book first, actually. And I feel like I've taken more of that sort of Philip Pullman idea of not talking down to people. And I'm like, is my book a YA book? That's how, you know, Unbound and publishers pushed it. And part of me was like, I feel like younger people could read it. But with the second book, it's definitely older, and it's dealing with, I think, even darker themes, and the idea of doing a different kind of plot, a different kind of world, and even using different kind of narrative techniques. I deliberately wanted this to be a very straightforward linear. We are basically with Krish the whole way through. But with the other books, I actually want there to be different storylines. And it's very careful, because you have to be with Krish most of the time. But yeah, I wanted the first one to be the simple, straightforward one. The second book is going to be a bit more complex, and not massively complex, not just as linear and as straightforward. And I'm really looking forward to it. And the darkness in this one is just something gorgeous. Love it. Mm. I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm trying to finish off the draft I'm working on at the moment before I start, you know, try and use it to get an agent. I think that's the best thing to do, to sort of revise and stuff. It's been even longer than the first book. So.
So I'm going to be a bit naughty here and say, does that mean that will we ever see Balthrea again? I mean, she was such a good character that I'd hate to think that she just vanished off the page like that. It's heartbreaking. You don't have to answer it. It's up to you.
All I would say was, hang around for the next book, and I wouldn't want to say anything. There is, there are... I'd like to stick with a rule that if you said you can't go back to the world, that you can't go back to the world. And that, you know, if you break rules, there are consequences, obviously. But, you will have to wait and see. But I like to challenge people and also make them, you know, give them that what they want at the same time, or give them, what they think they need. I don't think anyone's going to be disappointed, but I love the idea that it doesn't go in that things may not go in the direction people expect. But I'm very excited.
Yeah, that certainly happened in this book, because I was certainly thinking it was going to be a happy ending, a fluffy happy ending at the end of it, and we were heading that, it could have gone two ways. One, we get the happily ever after. The other is we don't get a happily ever after. But there's possibly a third issue where we're working towards helping kids get over a problem that, you know, of a parent dying before their time. None of that was the case. We took a left turn and went off somewhere else. Thought, okay, we'll go this way, and that's why it's not. It's not like a book I've ever read before. The ending was, you know, it's obvious that there's going to be another book after it. Whether it comes or not is a different thing. But it was setting itself up. Yeah, there will be, hopefully. But yes, there will be. There was a definite point where you say, oh, this is going to continue. It has to continue. But like you say, the distance between the first book and the second book is quite a big one. So. I can't wait for it. I can't wait for it to appear. So yeah, I'm You have a fan over here.
Thank you. I really can't wait. I think even more than the first book, I just want people to read the second one. It's a lot of work, and it's very strange that I didn't get a chance to finish working, like to do the first draft of the second book until the first lockdown started. You know, I've been working on this on and off, and I'm getting some momentum with it, but to actually have time to sit down and do it, when I was like, okay, I'm not going to have any work for a while. I'm just going to do something that, you know, I've been meaning to do for a long time. And I was like, I must have written about a third of the book in that time, which is just incredible for something I've been working on for years. And then in a month, it was like, wow, I had time and was able to do this financially. It shows you how tough it is for a lot of authors out there. When you speak to people, you'd never be surprised at how long it has taken them to do that, to actually be able to write for a living, and be a very, very tough thing. It's a very small percentage of writers that are, you know, lucky enough to able to do that. And you know, I'm not one of them, but I was just like, I'm taking advantage of this situation. I think the weird thing was that as lockdown started, I was like, oh Jesus, this, some of the things I've decided to do with this book years ago are oddly prophetic of what is happening at the moment. I'd say that one of the big differences between the first book and the second book is that the first book is written by somebody who's suffering from depression and doesn't realize it. The second book is written by somebody who does realize that and says, we need to like call a spade here and actually talk about this a bit. And not in the sort of like, it's going to keep coming back and screaming mental health at you all the time. But I was like, no, you don't linger on it. You don't say it too long, but you say it clearly. I think that's important sometimes, not to sort of, you know, the amount of times you see all these stories that are trying to tell you about love, peace and equality and things like that. It's like, maybe we should have just said it. Because sometimes people just don't get, oh, the alien race, that's about racism. Maybe we should have been a bit, sometimes I think it's actually good to be direct with these things, not push it so much that it annoys people, but be direct.
True. Well,
you mentioned earlier, Mark, just sorry to jump in, about Unbound and the process of actually getting the book out for people to read. Could you go into a little bit on that mm-hmm. process, like how that actually started, how it actually came about?
Yeah, sure. So it's interesting with somebody who, like, my first jobs were in marketing and in film companies. I sort of got a job as a runner and then managed to get a job doing sort of marketing at a really junior level. And then when I started working with Unbound, I realized the interesting thing was that Unbound, I think of in a lot of ways, cut marketing costs and instead work on the sort of the crowdfunding model of raising the money for the book that way, rather than investing your money in the book and then trying to advertise it massively and hope that it sticks, and some do and some don't. So from that, you know, it's an interesting and genius thing that it's not just Unbound or not Kickstarter. You can't just put anything on there. They pick stuff. And I'd read a book called The Idle Traveller, which I loved, by a guy called Dan Kieran. Looked him up, realised that he ran this company called Unbound, this crowdfunding publishers. And I sent an email saying, like, I would love to work for you. Here's some films I've made. And didn't get a reply. I found him on LinkedIn and sent that and said, just sent the same message. And he said, okay, come in and meet us. And somehow talked them into letting me make films. And that's kind of their thing, is that you make a crowdfunding video and then they try and raise the money for the book, and you're basically pre-ordering the book. That, you know, some authors decide to stop their crowdfunding campaign because it's not going somewhere or it's not for them. But it's a wonderful collaborative process. Like, you get people, like, everybody's names are in the book when you do something like that. It's a real community spirit around it. It can be tough and it can be really tough. But the idea is that, yeah, you are just raising the money to cover the costs. But at the end of that, you don't just have, you know, Kickstarter, and you've got to work out who's going to publish it and who's going to edit it and who's going to print it. The Unbound are the actual publisher. So you are with a publisher, but you're using crowdfunding to get there without that sort of huge marketing cost to try and get things out there. And they obviously do lots of marketing and stuff, and like any other place, they have flagship titles and they do what everything they can to support smaller and more niche titles as well. I think they have a love of anthology. The Good Immigrant's probably their most well known title, and yeah, that's their kind of model is the crowdfunding, but publishing at the end of that, proper publishing at the end of it. And they are publishers who I know have at the beginning struggled to get people to say, like, look, we are a publisher and this, and now they are becoming very respected. But they do, you know, I keep going back to this, it's not just any old platform. They are very selective. And because I was making films, I sort of I ended up just pitching something. I was so nervous that they used to do this pitching hour on Twitter. They may even do it, and I just tweeted something, and they knew me, so they were like, okay, that does actually sound interesting. And I had actually spent time being a marketing person, getting a cover design, because I thought, I'll give it away for free. I'll spend all the time doing the first book, give it away for free, and then maybe I can get a publisher to do the second one if it's a big hit. I'm glad I didn't do that, because I totally would have made a mess of that and wouldn't have been able to promote it, and like just family and friends would read it. So I had a cover designed, and I think that really helped feel like, oh, this could be good. And the cover you see by a guy called Lyle McCarthy, who was a friend of a filmmaker, friend of mine, Helen Nias, suggested him, and that cover I think has helped so much, and it's barely changed since the one that was originally made. And that, yeah, so I had to spend a lot of time speaking to everybody I know. And when you do these things, you speak to people directly, and you have to enjoy catching up with people, even if they say no to you. And it was kind of a wonderful and heartbreaking process to see people who would support you, and that sort of percentage of people who wouldn't. And sometimes it's financial, and you've just got to get on with it and speak to the next person. And that also feels horrible, because you're like, feel like you're just doing a sales thing and knocking on doors. But it's like, but I want to do this so much. And I was, in a way, it was nice to have that sort of thing, but it was, yeah, backbreaking at the same time. And then, yeah, since then, you know, it hit its target. It went over by a fair bit. And then, yeah, there was excitement. I even had at one point, in the crowdfunding campaign, got so much attention in some places that I had a film offer at one point that fell through. And then that was just weird. I've never had that attention like before or since. And yeah, now just going out there trying to promote it and stuff and finish the next one. And people keep asking me like, when, yeah.
Where would you insist on directing it? If ever came about?
No. I think that's somebody else's job. Like, I mean, it's weird, because I do definitely look at it and have my vision of, I mean, I love real locations as well. And I'd be like, oh, I lose money on this. I do the sort of Life of Pi thing where you spend a lot of money on getting the CG stuff really good. But then the other not Life of Pi thing, which is use real places as much as you possibly could. And, yeah, just concentrate a lot on characters. So yeah, I definitely have a vision for it, but I think it's actually better if I just get on with reading the books and someone else makes a, you know, it'd be good to see someone else's completely different take on it. And I bet they do something really different. But I mean, that is dream time, you know, if these things happen. Or maybe TV would be better, because, you know, I always feel like those characters sometimes get a bit more breathing space. Yeah,
it's easier to develop characters when you're on TV than it is in films, isn't it? You've got more time to do it. But yeah, it's got to be made into either a film or a miniseries or something. It's just the right sort of book for that. And then when we get you back on, we can say, and here is the filmmaker, you know, and writer, director of his own book. You know, it's just, you know, we've had him on before, you know, before he was famous.
Well, who knows what the... It'd probably be better if somebody else made it. Yeah.
Well, that, I mean, that's, it was just a great read. I'll definitely read it again.
Thank you.
It was just because the world that you made, I mean, the fact it's so small and you can walk around it in a few days, you know, a number of days rather than years or whatever. It's just, it's an unusual place, and it's stuck in my mind, and I've still got the images of the settings and the scenes and things in my head. So it's definitely done something right.
It's wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, I think there is a thing sometimes about sort of when you're a filmmaker, you think quite visually. There's on my own podcast, I interviewed a filmmaker and fantasy author called Yava Beidou, and it's quite interesting seeing, like, reading her books, how visual they were. You can see this as a filmmaker. She was, you know, we're all both very visual people.
That is a perfect segue into our next segment. Podcasting. Another string to the bow for the sickeningly talented Mark Belcher. We've got the podcast Poking Books. But generally speaking, we're going to hand over to Sean talking about how you got into podcasting, where the idea came from, and then feel free to sell Poking Books and just talk to us about it, please.
All right. Thanks, guys. Hello, Mark. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Hi, Sean.
They saved me for the end because I ask the hard-hitting questions. It's kind of like the big gun around here. So basically, the first thing I wanted to discuss is you're a filmmaker, you're a podcaster, you're an author. When do you find time to sleep? That's what the people want to know.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of films, the Haitian Revolution documentary working on recently, where I think I did 3 a.m. finish one night and 4 a.m. the next night. And it's, it's a struggle to sleep. And the, you know, Poking Books is something that we've not done for months because it takes up time. I love it. And I think it's a really important podcast, actually, but it's, it's finding time is the difficult thing.
It certainly can be. Now, I know that Dan and I have both been podcasting for 7 years, and I think Paul has got a similar background. How long has Poking Books been around for?
It's been around for just over a year, so it's fairly new.
Okay.
I think we started it in late 2019.
Okay. And what is the basic concept so that anybody who's listening, if they wanted to find your podcast, what would make them discover this podcast and listen to another one? Because there's so a limited amount of time for listening to different shows. Sell it for us. Why are we going to listen to it? What's it all about? What's the basic concept?
The main concept of it is that I was pretty sick as somebody who spent so much time, like, speaking to authors and meeting authors and always going out and making these films with authors. And then when you get a book podcast, they can be so dry, and there are good ones. There are good ones out there. But so often when you sit down and ask an author, like, the first thing they say, oh, what's your book about, or this or that? And I was just like, this is not the way to get to know an author. Don't ask them about that. Ask them about what they're reading. Ask them about what's really irked them. Ask them some random interesting facts about themselves. So I kind of wanted this experience that I've had of actually meeting authors, real human people, not just a name on a spine. So we do a podcast where you don't talk about what the book's about until the end. And in fact, you don't know what the book's about at all. I really wanted this experience of just getting to know the person first, and the book could be about anything. So the concept of it is, I bring an author home, and when I say this, we do it a bit virtual now, but at start it would be that I would bring an author home to my spare room, and they would meet my housemate Ellie. And then Ellie has to guess what their book is about. And to help Ellie, the author will give them three random facts about themselves. And then they will talk about three books that have influenced their book. I'm really fascinated by this idea that, you know, the books that influence you are often not the most obvious book. I would say that The Owl Who's Afraid of the Dark was an influence on The Boy Who Stole Time, actually the influence on all my writing, because of how it deals with darkness as not necessarily being more colourful than you'd think. But it's, yeah, so the main idea of it is to try and look at books as more than just, when you start with a book of, this is the title and this is the genre, and authors, I can tell you, hate trying to put their book into a genre and say it is just one thing, and only people who like fantasy books or like books on finance or whatever it is will like this book. Authors hate that, and it's not reflective of their books most of the time anyway. They're always much more complex than that. So I really wanted to do something that is a guessing game. It's a literary guessing game, but it's just getting to know authors and realizing their books have so much more to them than if you start with a synopsis.
Right, because a book is a living, breathing thing, and it's not just about one thing. It could cover so many different things. And so I haven't, I didn't know about your podcast until we started recording today, but this concept that you're talking about, where you don't even talk about the book, but you talk about what makes the author tick, that's fantastic. So what books are you reading these days, sir?
I've actually completely forgotten what book I'm reading right now. I mean, I kind of have a thing that with every book that I want to have something different to what I just read before. The book that I talked about to a lot of people recently was a book called The 392, who's actually an author. Ashley was on our podcast, and The 392 is about a bus journey where a suspicious character gets on and all these different people, it's all different perspectives. And Ashley wrote this book on his phone, and it's a really, really good, fast-moving, engaging book. I tried to read Dickens over Christmas because I thought that would feel a bit festive and regretted it. What else have I been reading? Andrea Levy's Small Island, which I saw at the National Theatre a couple of years ago, is a book that I keep telling people is a really quietly devastating and beautiful book, and everybody should read that. I try and read as much as I can because I've read some Terry Pratchett recently, so sometimes I read a bit of fantasy. I quite want to read a John le Carré because we rewatched The Night Manager recently. Oh yes, I remember what I'm reading. I'm reading Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death, as in Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death. And it's all about a guy. It's by the poet Selena Godden. And it is fantastic. I can easily see this already being my favorite book of the year, because it's a book about death that's somehow not depressing, and it's so magical, it's so lyrical, and you get these poems and this idea that death isn't the guy with the scythe. It's a sort of black woman who sort of sits in the background and is just, you never really notice she's there, and she's telling her life story to this guy, and it is an absolutely phenomenal book and so captivating. It refreshes itself on every line. When you it's a difficult book to get sick of. It's absolutely engrossing. Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death. I'm halfway through, so if I change my mind at the end, I'll be very disappointed. But so far, it is incredible.
And are you going to have the author of that book on your show?
I would love to. I've had a couple of social media interactions. Selena Godden's very, very responsive to people on social media. And she kind of, I've always wanted to have sort of not the most well-known authors on, not the biggest of the big. And she, I think, is fairly well-known in a lot of circles, but still not a household name for everybody. And I would just like to have people who are a little bit bigger to boost the smaller authors, and just, yeah, be great. And I she'd just be fantastic. So I think I will definitely ask her.
That's a good idea. Here's a silly question for you. Have you had our very own Daniel Peter Hitch on your Poking Books podcast, since he is actually a writer himself?
We have got an episode on Dan, and like many episodes we recorded back then, I've sat on them for a long time and not done anything with them. There are some episodes we've got from about a year ago. Dan is doing dismissive gestures right now. I have bad news for you, Dan, that Ellie has been chasing me recently to get back on track with the podcast. She's desperate to get on with it. I'm the one who's been struggling to find time. So I've been editing the next episode, which will probably be called Ava and the Unexpected Apple and Brie Sandwich. They always have quite random titles, but I think Dan will be the one after that.
Excellent.
We kind of want to clear, we've got about four that we've recorded and haven't had a chance to use, so Dan should be there pretty soon.
Perfect. And in an ideal situation, do the episodes come out once a week, every 2 weeks?
Every 2 weeks. In fact, we had this aim and then we've taken a break for a few months and we're going to go back to doing every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks. Okay. And what is the general length of your episodes?
Usually about 45 minutes, I think. We sort of started off a bit shorter, but usually around 45 to 50 minutes.
Ah, perfect. Okay. And it's called Poking Books. And let's sell it. Where can people find it? Everywhere, pretty much?
Yeah. I mean, if you look, Poking Books, quite a unique title. Wherever you get your podcasts, just search for Perkins. I can't say search. I've just searched for Poking Books.
Excellent. Well, this is awesome. It's another podcast that I can add to my queue and devour and learn about new authors and stuff. I think that's fantastic. Thanks for bringing them along, Dan.
Of course. Only the best.
All right. And that's all the questions I have. Back to you, Dan.
Cool. That's our big three meaty pizzas there, pizza cut into three slices, I think it was. Thank you very much, Mark. This has been absolutely fantastic. We've got obviously the book. We've got the sequel at some point. We've got podcasts. We've got movies coming up. You mentioned earlier that you had a production company. Rabbit Island Productions. Do you want to go into a little bit more about how that came to be and where the name comes from?
So back around whenever 2008 is. How long ago is that? A while back.
A long time.
I sort of quit my job and saved up some money and went traveling, and Rabbit Island in Cambodia, Koh Tonsay, it's probably one of my favorite places. Like it's a place where there was no electricity and no roads. You could just sit there and relax. And it was wonderful. I just thought Rabbit Island was a great name. So So Rabbit Island Productions has basically been me, but more and more I've tried to work with other people. And as there are sort of possibilities that could be producing more documentaries, and my eternal hope of moving into doing fiction and stuff like that. I think Iris Gibson, who I work with, I think she's going to be directing a number of films as well for History Hit. And we're going to be looking at other filmmakers, hopefully around the world as well. I think we don't just want to be working in the UK. It's the lockdown has had a positive thing of I've started to think a lot more globally. And yeah, that's a really nice idea. And so you can go to rabbitislandpro.co.uk to check us out.
Excellent. Now, you've mentioned fiction there. Now, on The Cosmic Pizza, we talk about all kinds of geeky stuff. We're part of the ESO network where lots of different geeky shows get discussed, particularly Doctor Who. Now, I think you might be a Whovian by some chance.
A massive Whovian.
I haven't actually had a chance to catch up with you for a while. In fact, we've had a whole new Doctor since we last saw you. I'd love to get your take on the new Doctor and just talk about Doctor Who for a little bit.
Oh God. I mean, Doctor Who right now is very complicated. What are you just after a general consensus on?
General idea, you know, you liking where it's going, anything you would change, you know, if you were directing it, you know, where would you take it? If you took over from Chibnall right now, where would you go with it?
I wouldn't like to take over from Chibnall right now. Actually, interestingly, I would like to see, I think it would be good if it went in a different direction. There sort of seems to be a sort of, if the showrunner leaves, the Doctor leaves, and it's sort of all attached to each other. My feeling is very mixed on a show I absolutely love, and I, it's so like as such a perfectionist that I, you know, there's not an era of Doctor Who that's perfect at all. But I appreciate the last few of how good Russell T. Davies was with the very accessible, unsnobbish sort of stuff. He goes a bit too into sentimentality sometimes, but when he got it, he was absolutely perfect. And Stephen Moffat, I think, was trying to be too clever, but the humour and the points when he gets things emotionally, particularly with Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman, I think when they had this more platonic friendship relationship, it's quite deep. There's that bit where they hug, and it's all about hugging is about hiding your face. And there were moments when it would just build up to something brilliant and be slightly thrown away. But I still have such admiration for that. Chris Chibnall, I'm a lot more mixed about. I think I would love to see a showrunner who is better at who is better at sort of understanding both a mixture of casting and writing side of things. There have been some great stuff. I think their take on having historicals has been really, really nice. I would love to see them do something more about that, because I do get sick of seeing, like, you know, I'm fascinated and love Victorian London, but it's been so good to see stuff that's outside of that. I think that the Demons of the Punjab episode, with that sort of, I was, you know, my grandparents are the first married in Pakistan. You're like, what does that even mean? And it's, that is such a good idea for something. And there's been, I'm trying to remember that there have been some very good writers. I think Vinny Patel, who did Demons of the Punjab, and then what was the other episode? He's done a few very good ones, and The Prisoner of Jaduna, I think that was one of his, and also The Director, I noticed, was particularly good. Never forget the directors, how good they are. That was one of the best combinations. And what I've enjoyed about it is also the thing I found most difficult about it. The end of the last series sort of did this thing of completely sort of changing our idea of the Doctor. And what I think was brilliant about that was that Chris Chibnall was massively, massively, massively criticized for being dull. And then he did something that was very difficult to unwrite and ignore, and was brave. And there's always this problem that, do people want to know who the Doctor is? Do they always want this to be a mystery? Do we ever want a definitive end to it? You know, it's kind of a series that should have a question mark in its title, but it doesn't. It's got this sort of, yeah. And I loved how he sort of threw the gauntlet down with that. I don't think I necessarily liked it, because I think the more and more Doctors you have, the less special it feels. And you get people like, you know, Paul McGann, who never had a proper run as the Doctor. And I have this real fear that Joe Martin will be done the same disservice. And I kind of feel very mixed, because I would love to see a new showrunner come in to really push Jodie Whittaker, because there've been times when I've just felt like the characterization has been a little bit weak. But then I've seen people who said, like, we love the fact that instead of being an egotist, she's shown this real tender sort of vulnerable woman in some things, and it's not also about that being a weakness, it's about it being honest and transparent. There's some really good stuff in that. It's underutilized. And I think I'll be honest, I shouldn't be in charge of this. There's not been a, since they've had a formal showrunner, it's always been a bloke. It would be good if there was a pairing of female Doctor and female showrunner, at least before, you know, before some other bloke does it. And it's not that they're bad people, it's just, you know, you you said you can always find a woman to play the Doctor. Of course you can. But, you know, the showrunners as well have to go hand in hand in that. And I would love to see that. And I think what would be best is if Chris Chibnall took a sidestep and did a spin-off series with Joe Martin, where he could do something more his own style. Maybe he could be more serious and procedural and old school Doctor Who about it. And maybe that was complement what was good about Broadchurch. So I would love to see that sidestep of him doing that. And then someone else giving Jodie Whittaker a really good send off, because there's such underutilized stuff in her character that's waiting to be let out. I don't think that situation could happen, to be honest, because that's not really how showrunners leave, is they don't take sort of sidesteps, but that's my ideal scenario. There was also an Irish Ethiopian actress called Ruth Negger, who was in Preacher, who would be an amazing doctor, by the way. Anyway.
That's great.
That's my opinions.
All right, well, we've heard the pitch. That's good. So anyone else listening out there, that's easy for them to get onto. So there we go. I've actually started Preacher, but I still haven't got up to it. I think I'm about 3 or 4 episodes into season one. So I'm looking forward to sort of getting onto that, seeing where she was. You guys, any particular questions, any geeky stuff, any banter out there?
No, I've learned a lot. I've got podcasts and books and movies to watch now, and I'll add them to the list of things that I'll try to get to, but I'm under an avalanche of pop culture. So,
well, if you do go on to History Hit, they are a subscription service, but you can do a free trial. And now is probably the best time to do a month's free trial, because I will have 5 up on there soon. So if you look up Culture of Memory, Hatshepsut, Independence or Death, which is about the Haitian Revolution, Mansa Musa, or the First Britons, which will go up pretty soon, then yeah, you can binge watch them.
Independence or Death sounds like something out of The Life of Brian. Independence or Death? Independence. Ah, yes.
It's genuinely the it was their rallying call in the Haitian Revolution. It came out of one of the interviews. Professor Marlene Dout said that they sort of took up the call of liberty or death, and then when they were really pushed, and there was just some terrible genocidal tactics going on, they changed it. They didn't just want liberty, they wanted independence from France. So that's how it came about. Independence or death came from liberty or death.
Wow.
It was just called the Haitian Revolution originally, and that was a much more interesting and provocative title. It is full on that story, the Haitian Revolution. I really recommend. They even put it on free for Haitian Independence Day, which was the 1st of January. They put it on for a week, and I was told that the viewing figures for it went through the roof. It had an incredible response. And although I made it, the story is Jean Casimir in Haiti. It's his words, and it's the words of Marlene Dout, who's a Haitian American. And it's very provocative. I'd really, recommend it.
Excellent. Well, we've got History Hit, we've got the documentaries, we've got the podcast, we've got Poking Books, and we've got The Boy Who Stole Time. So all of our listeners, go right. You've got plenty to delve into, no matter what lockdown you might be in, wherever you might be stuck at home. You've got plenty of Mark Bauscher's wonderful talent to delve into. So thank you very much, Mark Bauscher, our guest today. We've had some lovely feedback on Twitter, people sharing all of it. Mike Crate at Jarek still resharing all of our episodes and retweeting it along with all of the other podcasts. He is the podcast guru. Thank you again to at Jarek. He is constantly retweeting us and recommending us to loads of people. So thank you very much. But I guess that's it. So our special is gone and the grease in the box is cold. And we hope you are full to the brim of all 3 slices of this pizza. So join us for more slices next time when our special delivery of the Cosmic Pizza podcast comes in 2 weeks' time. We've been your
us today, please leave a tip at the door by subscribing for future deliveries, rate and review our service, and we hope you come back for more helpings next time. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr and TikTok by searching for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. If you would like to send us an MP3 file, you can email us on cosmicpizzapodcast@hotmail.com, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.